Any luck with Frère Raymond in the basement? Beauvoir looked lost for a moment. Frère Raymond? Then he remembered. Had that even happened? It seemed so long ago. The foundations look okay to me, and no sign of a steel pipe. Well, no need to look further. I've found the murder weapon. Gamache handed the towel to his second in command. Above them, the bell stopped ringing. Beauvoir carefully unwrapped the package. There, in the folds, was the iron knocker. He looked at it, not touching, then up at Gamache. How do you know this is what killed him? The chief inspector told him about his conversation with Frère Simon. The Blessed Chapel was very quiet now, and Gamache kept his voice in the lowest register. When he looked up, it was to see that the chief superintendent had arrived and was sitting in a pew across from them and down a row. The gap between them, it seemed, was widening. This was fine with Gamache. Beauvoir wrapped the length of iron back up. I'll put it in an evidence bag. Not much hope of forensics, though.
I agree, whispered the chief.
From the wings of the chapel came a now familiar sound, a single voice. A Frère Antoine, Gamache recognized, alone, came in first, the new choirmaster. Then his rich tenor was joined by another voice, Frère Bernard, who collected eggs and wild blueberries. His voice was higher, less rich, but more precise. Then Brother Charles, the médecin, walked in, his tenor filling in the gaps between the two first monks. One after another the brothers filed in, their voices joining, mixing, complimenting, giving a plain chant depth and life. As beautiful as the music had been on CD, as wonderful as it had been yesterday, it was even more glorious now. Gamache could feel himself both invigorated and relaxed, calmed and enlivened. The chief wondered if it was simply because he knew the monks now, or if it was something less tangible, some shift in the monks that came with the death of their old choirmaster and the ascension of the new. One after another the monks walked in, singing, Frère Simon, Frère Raymond, and then, at last, Frère Luc. And everything changed. His voice, not a tenor, not a baritone, neither, yet both, joined the rest. And suddenly the individual voices, the individual notes, were connected, joined, held in an embrace, as though the neumes had lengthened and become arms, and were holding each monk and each man listening. It became whole. No more wounds, no more damage. The holes became whole, the damage repaired. Frère Luc sang the simple chant, simply. No histrionics, no hysteria, but with a passion and fullness of spirit that Gamache hadn't noticed before. It was as though the young monk was free, and being freed, he gave new life to the gliding, soaring neumes. Gamache listened, struck dumb by the beauty of it, by the way the voices claimed not just his head, but his heart, his chest, his legs, his hands, the scar on his head and his chest, and the tremble in his hand. The music held him, safe and whole. Frère Luc's voice had done that. The others alone were magnificent, but Frère Luc elevated them to the divine. What had he told Gamache? I am the harmony? It seemed the simple truth. Beside Gamache on the bench, Jean-Guy Beauvoir had closed his eyes and felt himself slip away to that familiar world where nothing mattered. There was no more pain, no more ache, no more uncertainty. Everything would be fine. And then the music stopped. The last note died away, and there was silence. The abbot stepped forward, made the sign of the cross, opened his mouth, and stood there, stunned by another sound, one never heard during Vespers, never before heard during any prayer service at Saint-Gilbert-Entre-les-Loups. It was a rod on wood, pounding. Someone was at the door. Someone wanted in. Or out. Chapter 27. Dom Philippe tried not to notice. He intoned a blessing, heard the response, gave the next call. He'd become quite good, he realized, at not noticing, at shutting out unpleasantness. His vow of silence had been expanded to include a vow of deafness.
Much longer, and he'd be completely senseless. Standing perfectly still, he surrendered to God. Then Dom Philippe sang, in a voice no longer young and vigorous, but still filled with adoration, the next line of the prayer, and heard the pounding on the gate as though in response. Lord, have mercy, he sang, pounding. Christ, have mercy, pounding. Holy Trinity, have mercy on him, pounding. The abbot's mind went blank. For the first time in decades, after hundreds, thousands of services, his mind went blank. The peace of Christ, the grace of God, had been replaced by pounding, pounding, like a giant metronome, pounding at the gate. The monks, lined up on either side of him, looked at him for guidance. O God, help me, he prayed. What should I do? The pounding wouldn't stop, he realized. It had taken on a rhythm, a dead, repetitive thumping, as though a machine was doing it. Bang, bang, bang. It would go on forever until it was answered. The abbot did something he'd never, ever done before, not as a novice, not in all his years as a monk, and now as abbot. The thousands of services he'd celebrated, he'd never once left. But he did now. He bowed to the cross, then turning his back on the congregation, he walked off the altar. His heart was pounding too, but much faster than the banging at the gate. He could feel perspiration beneath his robes. They felt heavy as he walked down the long aisle, past that superintendent of the Sûreté with his clever eyes and clever face, past the young inspector who seemed so anxious to be anywhere other than where he was, past the chief inspector who listened so closely as though trying to find answers not just for the crime but for himself. Dom Philippe walked past them all. He tried not to rush, told himself to be measured, to walk with purpose but with containment. The pounding continued, not louder, not softer, not faster, but neither did it slow. It kept an almost inhuman consistency. And the abbot found himself rushing toward it, desperate to make it stop, the noise that had shattered vespers, and finally blown a hole through his determined calm. Behind Dom Philippe, the monks followed in a long, thin line, hands up sleeves, heads bowed, feet hurrying along, trying to keep up while not appearing to run. As the last monk left the altar, the Sûreté officers joined them, Gamache and Beauvoir a step behind Francoeur. Dom Philippe exited the Blessed Chapel and turned down the long, long corridor, with the door at the very end. He knew it was a trick of his imagination, but the wood seemed to strain forward with each thump. Lord, have mercy, he prayed as he approached the door. It was the last prayer he'd said on the altar, and the only one that had stayed with him, clinging on when everything else had fled. Lord, have mercy. O dear God, have mercy. At the door, the abbot stopped. Should he look through the slat to see who was there? But would it matter? Whoever was there wouldn't stop, the abbot knew, until the heavy door had been opened. He realized he didn't have a key. Where was the Frère Portier? Would he have to go all the way back to the Blessed Chapel to get the key? The abbot turned and was surprised to see the other monks in a semicircle behind him, like a choir about to sing Christmas carols. All ye faithful had come, but they were hardly joyful and triumphant. They looked more glum and distressed. But they were there. The abbot was not alone. God did have mercy. Frère Luc appeared beside him, the key shaking slightly in his slender hand. Give it to me, my son, said the abbot. But it's my job, mon père. Bang, bang, bang on the door. Dom Philippe kept his hand out. This job falls to me, he said, and smiled at the alarmed young monk. With trembling hands, Frère Luc unclipped the heavy metal key and gave it to the abbot, then stepped back. Dom Philippe, his own hand unsteady, thrust back the deadbolt. Then he tried to get the key in the lock. Bang, bang. He brought his other hand up to steady the key, to help guide it. Bang. It slid into place, and he turned it. The banging stopped. Whoever was on the other side had heard, through the banging, the thin metallic click as the door unlocked. The gate opened. It was twilight, the sun almost set. The mist was thicker now. Some light spilled out of the monastery from the crack in the door, but no light came in.
"Oui," said the abbot, wishing his voice sounded firmer, more authoritative.
"Dom Philippe." The voice was polite, respectful, disembodied.
"Oui,"
said the abbot, his voice still not his own.
"May I come in? I've come a long way."
"Who are you?" asked the abbot. It seemed a reasonable question.
"Does it matter? Would you really turn a person away on a night like this?"
It seemed a reasonable answer. But reason wasn't the Gilbertine's long suit. Passion, commitment, loyalty, music. But not, perhaps, reason. Still, Dom Philippe realized the voice was right. He couldn't possibly shut the door now. It was far too late. Once opened, whatever was out there had to come in. He stepped back. Behind him he heard, as one, the rest of the congregation step back. But out of his peripheral vision he noticed two people holding their ground. Chief Inspector Gamache and his Inspector Beauvoir. A foot stepped in, well shod in black leather, with mud and a piece of bright dead leaf stuck to it. And then the man was in. He was slender and of medium height, slightly shorter than the abbot. His eyes were light brown, as was his hair, and his skin was pale, except for a slight flush from the cold.
"Merci, mon père."
He hauled in a duffel bag and turned to look at his hosts. He smiled then, fully and completely. Not with amusement, but with wonderment.
"At last," he said, "I found you."
He wasn't handsome, nor was he hideous. He was unremarkable, except for one thing. What he wore. He was also in a monk's robes, but while the Gilbertine wore a white surplice on black, his robes were black on white.
"The Hound of the Lord," one of the monks whispered.
When Gamache turned to see which of them had spoken, he saw they all had their mouths slightly opened.
"We don't use that term anymore," said the new arrival, scanning the men in front of him, his smile widening. "It puts people off."
His voice was pleasant as he continued to stare at them. The Gilbertine stared back, not smiling. Finally, the stranger turned to Dom Philippe and offered his hand. The abbot, silently, took it. The young man bowed, then straightened up.
"My name is Brother Sébastien. I've come from Rome."
"Tonight?" asked the abbot, and immediately regretted the stupidity of the question. But he'd heard no plane, nor had he heard the motorboat. "I flew in from Rome this morning and made my way here."
"But how?" the abbot asked.
"I paddled." Now it was Dom Philippe's turn to stare, his mouth slightly open. Frère Sébastien laughed. It was, like the rest of him, pleasant.
"I know, not my most brilliant idea. A small plane got me to the local airfield, but the fog was getting too thick, and no one wanted to take me the rest of the way, so I decided to take myself."
He turned to look at Gamache, paused, perplexed, then looked back at the abbot.
"You were much farther away than I realized."
"You paddled all this way? From the village?"
"I did."
"But that's miles. How do you even know where to go?" The abbot willed himself to be quiet, but he couldn't seem to stop the questions.
"The boatman directed me. Said to keep going past three bays and to turn right at the fourth."
He seemed delighted by the directions.
"But the mist got really heavy, and I was afraid I'd made my last mistake. But then I heard your bells and followed the sound. When I got to the head of the bay, I saw your lights. You have no idea how happy I am to find you."
And he looked happy, thought Gamache. In fact, he looked ecstatic. He kept staring at the monks as though he wasn't one himself, as though he'd never met a religieux.
"Have you come because of the prior?" asked Dom Philippe.
And Gamache had a sudden insight. He stepped forward, but it was too late.
"About his murder?" the abbot asked.
The abbot, a man who longed for great silence, had said too much. Gamache took a deep breath, and Frère Sébastien looked over at him. Then his gaze shifted to Beauvoir, before finally resting on Superintendent Francoeur. The smile slid from the young monk's face, to be replaced by a look of great sympathy. He crossed himself and kissed his thumb, then folded his long hands in front of himself and bowed slightly, his eyes grave. "That's why I was in such a rush. I came as soon as I heard. God rest his soul." Now all the monks crossed themselves, while Chief Inspector Gamache studied the newcomer. The man who'd paddled through the gathering darkness, through the gathering mist, across an unfamiliar lake, and finally found the abbey by following the sound and the light. He'd travelled all the way from Rome, desperate, it would seem, to reach Saint-Gilbert entre les loups. So desperate he'd taken his life in his hands. This young man, while making a joke about his foolish decision-making, looked extremely competent to Gamache. So why had he taken such a risk? What couldn't wait until morning? It wasn't the prior's murder, Gamache was sure of that. He'd known in the instant Dom Philippe had asked that this stranger knew nothing about it. It was news to Frère Sébastien. If he'd really come all the way from Rome because of the prior's death, he'd have been more solemn, would have offered his sympathies right away. Instead, he'd laughed at his own folly, talked of his travels, said how happy he was to see them, marvelled at the monks, but hadn't once mentioned Frère Mathieu. No. Frère Sébastien had a reason to be there, and an important one, but it had nothing to do with Frère Mathieu's death. "Were those the Vesper bells?" Frère Sébastien asked. "I'm so sorry, mon père, to have interrupted. Please continue." The abbot hesitated, then turned and walked back down the long corridor, the newcomer behind him looking this way and that. Gamache watched him closely. It was as though the visitor had never been in a monastery before. The chief signalled Brother Charles to stay at the back of the procession with him. He waited until the others were a good distance ahead, then turned to the doctor. "Was it you who called Frère Sébastien the Hound of the Lord?" "Well, I didn't mean him personally." The doctor looked pale, shaken, not his jovial self. In fact, he looked considerably more upset about the live stranger than the dead prior.
"Then what did you mean?" insisted Gamache.
They were almost in the Blessed Chapel, and he wanted to finish this conversation before entering the church. Not out of some sense of religious propriety, but because of the astonishing acoustics. This conversation must remain private. "He's a Dominican," said Brother Charles, his voice also low, his eyes never leaving the head of the procession, Frère Sébastien and the abbot.
"How do you know?"
"His robes and belt, Dominican."
"But how does that make him the Hound of the Lord?"
The head of the procession, like the head of a snake, had entered the Blessed Chapel and the rest were following. "Dominican," Brother Charles repeated. "Dominicanus, Hound of the Lord." Then they too entered the Blessed Chapel and all conversation ended. Brother Charles gave Gamache a small nod and followed his fellow monks back onto the altar, where they took their places. Frère Sébastien genuflected, crossed himself, then sat in a pew, craning his neck, looking this way and that. A Beauvoir had returned to the pew, and Gamache frowned as Superintendent Francais joined Jean-Guy. Gamache walked around and slid into the seat on the other side of Beauvoir, so that the inspector was bracketed by his bosses. But Beauvoir didn't care. As Vespers began again, he closed his eyes and imagined himself in Annie's apartment, lying together on the sofa in front of the fireplace. She'd be in the crook of his arm. He'd be holding her secure. Every other woman he dated, and Enid, whom he'd married, had been tiny, slender, petite. Annie Gamache was not. She was athletic, full-bodied, strong. And when she lay with him, clothed or not, they fit together perfectly. "I never want this to end," Annie would whisper. "It won't," he'd assure her. "Never, ever." "It'll change, though, when people find out." "It'll be even better," he'd say. "Oui," Annie would agree. "But I like it like this, just us." And he liked it like that, too. Now, in the Blessed Chapel, with its scent of incense and candles, he imagined he heard the murmur of the fireplace, smelled the sweet maple logs, tasted the red wine, and could feel Annie on his chest. The music began. At once, from some signal invisible to Gamache, the monks went from still and silent to full voice. Their voices filled the chapel like air in lungs. It seemed to emanate from the rocks of the walls, as though the Gregorian chants were as much a part of the abbey as the stones and slate and wooden beams. In front of Gamache, Frère Sébastien stared, transfixed, unmoving. His mouth was open slightly, and there was a glistening down his pale cheek. Frère Sébastien listened to the Gilbertines sing their service and wept, as though he'd never heard the voice of God before. Dinner that night was an almost silent affair. Since Vespers ended late, the brothers and their guests had gone directly to the dining hall. Tureens filled with brilliant pea and mint soup sat on the table, next to baskets of fresh, warm baguette. A brother sang the prayer of thanksgiving for the meal, the monks crossed themselves, and then the only sound was of the soup being served and spoons against earthenware bowls. And then a low hum was heard. In any other environment it would have been inaudible, but here, in the silence, it sounded as loud as the boatman's engine. And it got louder and louder. The monks, one by one, stopped eating, and soon the only sound in the long dining hall was the humming. Every head turned to see where it was coming from. It came from Chief Inspector Gamache. He sipped his soup and he hummed, looking down at his plate, apparently engrossed in the delicious meal. Then, perhaps sensing scrutiny, he looked up. But the humming didn't stop. Gamache smiled a little as he hummed, and looked at the faces of the monks. Some looked scandalized, some looked worried, as though a madman had appeared. Some looked angry, to have their peace disturbed. Beauvoir looked blank, his soup untouched in front of him, his appetite gone. Francois shook his head slightly, as though ashamed. One monk looked frightened, Frère Simon. "What's that you're humming?" The question came from the head of the table, but not from Dom Philippe. It was the Dominican who'd asked the question. His young face was interested, good-natured, not angry, not pained, not scandalized. In fact, Frère Sébastien seemed sincerely interested. "I'm sorry," said Gamache. "I didn't realize I was humming so loud. Désolé." But the chief inspector didn't look at all desolated. "I think it's a Canadian folk song," said Frère Simon, his voice slightly higher than usual. "Is that right? It's very pretty." "Actually, mon frère," said Gamache, and beside him Frère Simon was squirming and knocking his knee against Gamache beneath the table. "It's a chant. I have it stuck in my head, can't seem to get it out." "It's not a chant," said Simon quickly. "He thinks it is, but I was trying to explain that a chant is much simpler." "Whatever it is, it's very beautiful," said Frère Sébastien. "Much better than the song it replaced in my head, Camp Town Races." "A Camp Town race track's 5 miles long, do-da, do-da," Frère Sébastien sang. "That one?" All eyes swung from the chief inspector to the newcomer. Even Gamache was speechless for a moment. Frère Sébastien had made the silly old song sound like a work of genius, as though Mozart or Handel or Beethoven had written it. If the works of Da Vinci could turn themselves into music, they'd have sounded like that. "All the doodah day," Frère Sébastien concluded with a smile. These monks, who sang so gloriously for God, looked at the Dominican as though at a brand new creature. "Who are you?" It was Frère Antoine who asked, the new choir master. He wasn't demanding, not at all accusing. His face and voice held a note of wonderment Gamache hadn't heard before. The chief looked at the other monks. The discomfort had disappeared, the anxiety gone. Frère Simon had forgotten to be taciturn. Brother Charles was no longer fearful. What they did look was deeply curious. "I'm Frère Sébastien, a simple Dominican friar." "But who are you?" Frère Antoine asked. Frère Sébastien carefully folded his napkin and placed it in front of him. Then he looked down the long wooden table, worn and marked by hundreds and hundreds of years of Gilbertine sitting at it. "I said I came from Rome," he began, "but I wasn't very specific.
I come from the palace of the Holy Office at the Vatican. I work at the CDF.
Now the silence was profound.
The CDF? Gamache asked.
The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. Frère Sébastien turned to Gamache and clarified. He had an apologetic look on his nondescript face. Fear had crept back into the room. Whereas before it seemed vague, without form, now it had a form and a focus. The pleasant young monk at the head of the table, sitting beside the abbot. The hound of the Lord. As he looked at Frère Sébastien and Dom Philippe side by side, the chief inspector was reminded of the unlikely emblem of Saint-Gilbert entre les loups. Two wolves, intertwined. One wore black on white, the other, the abbot, wore white on black. Polar opposites. Sébastien, young and vital, Dom Philippe, older and aging by the moment. Entre les loups. Among the wolves.
The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith? Asked Gamache.
The Inquisition, said Frère Simon, in a very small voice.
Chapter 28. Gamache and Beauvoir waited until they were back in the prior's office to talk. Superintendent Francois had corralled the newcomer right after dinner, and the two had stayed in the dining hall. Everyone else had left as soon as they politely could.
"Geez," said Beauvoir. "The Inquisition. I didn't expect that."
"No one does," said Gamache.
"There hasn't been an Inquisition in hundreds of years. I wonder why he's here."
Beauvoir crossed his arms and leaned against the door, while Gamache sat behind the desk. Only then did he notice the other chair was broken, and leaning, crooked, in a corner. Gamache said nothing, but looked at Beauvoir and raised a brow.
"A slight disagreement."
"With the chair?"
"With the superintendent. No one was hurt," he hurriedly added on seeing the chief's face. But the assurance didn't seem to work. Gamache continued to look upset.
"What happened?"
"Nothing. He said some stupid things and I disagreed."
"I told you not to engage him, not to argue. It's what he does. He gets into people's heads."
"And what was I supposed to do? Just nod and bow and take his shit?"
"You might, but I won't."
The two men stared at each other for a moment.
"Sorry," said Beauvoir, and stood up straight. He wiped his tired face with his hands, then looked at Gamache. The chief was no longer looking angry. Now he looked concerned.
"Has something happened? What did the superintendent say?"
"Oh, just the usual crap, that you don't know what you're doing and I'm exactly like you."
"And that made you angry?"
"To be compared to you? Who wouldn't be?" Beauvoir laughed, but he could see the chief wasn't amused. He continued to examine Beauvoir.
"Are you all right?"
"God, why do you always ask that? As soon as I get angry or upset, you think I'm that fragile?"
"Are you all right?" Gamache repeated, and waited.
"Oh, fuck," said Beauvoir, and leaned heavily against the wall. "I'm just tired, and this place is getting to me. And now this new monk, this Dominican, I feel like I've landed on another planet. They're speaking the same language as me, but I keep thinking they're saying more than I understand, you know?"
"I do."
Gamache kept his gaze on Beauvoir, then looked away, deciding to let it drop for the moment. But something had clearly crawled inside the younger man's skin, and Gamache could guess what, or who. Chief Superintendent Francois had many skills, Gamache knew. It was a terrible mistake to underestimate him. And in all the years they'd worked together, Gamache knew that Francois's greatest gift was bringing out the worst in people. However well hidden that demon, Francois would find it, and Francois would free it and feed it until it consumed its host and became the man. Gamache had seen decent young Sûreté officers turned into cynical, vicious, strutting thugs, young men and women with little conscience and big guns, and a superior who modelled and rewarded their behaviour. Once again Gamache looked at Beauvoir, leaning exhausted against the wall. Somehow, Francois had gotten into Jean-Guy. He'd found the entrance, found the wound, and was roaming around inside him, looking to do even more damage. And Gamache had allowed it. He felt himself almost quaking with rage. In a flash it had claimed his core and raced to his extremities, so that his hands closed into white-knuckled fists. Rage was transforming him, and Gamache fought to regain control, to grip his humanity and haul himself back. François wouldn't get this young man, Gamache vowed. It stops here. He got up, excused himself, and left the room. Beauvoir waited for a few minutes, thinking the chief must have gone down the hall to the washrooms. But when he didn't return, Beauvoir got up and went into the hallway, looking this way and that. The halls were dim, the light low. He checked the washrooms. No Gamache. He knocked on the chief's cell, and when there was no answer, poked his head in. No Gamache. Beauvoir was at a loss. Now what? He could text Annie. Taking out his BlackBerry, he checked. There was a message from her. She was having dinner with friends and would email him when she got home. It was short and cheerful. Too short, thought Beauvoir. Too cheerful? Was there perhaps just a hint of abruptness about the message? A dismissiveness? Not caring that he was still working well into the night? That he couldn't just drop everything and go for drinks and dinner with friends? He stood in the murky hallway and imagined Annie at that terrasse she liked on Laurier. Young professionals, drinking microbrewery ales. Annie laughing, having a good time, without him. "Would you like to see what's behind that?" The voice, more than the question, made François jerk in a small spasm of surprise. The superintendent had been looking at the plaque to Saint-Gilbert when Gamache walked quietly across the Blessed Chapel. Without waiting for a reply, Gamache reached over and depressed the two wolves. The door swung open to reveal the hidden chapter house. "I think we should go in, don't you?" Gamache placed a large, firm hand on François's shoulder and propelled him into the room. It wasn't a shove, exactly. A witness would never testify that there was any assault. But both men knew it was neither François's idea to enter the room nor his own steam. Gamache closed the door, then turned to face his superior. "What did you say to Inspector Beauvoir?" "Let me out of here, Armand." Gamache considered him for a moment. "Are you afraid of me?" "Of course not." But François looked a little frightened. "Would you like to leave?" Gamache's voice was friendly, but his eyes were cold and hard, and his stance, in front of the door, unyielding. François was silent for a moment, assessing the situation. "Why don't you ask your inspector what happened? Stop the schoolyard game, Sylvain. You came here with an agenda. I thought it was to screw with me, but it wasn't, was it? You knew I wouldn't care. So you took off after Inspector Beauvoir. He's still recovering from his wounds." François made a gruff, dismissive noise. "You don't believe that?" asked Gamache. "Everyone else recovered. You recovered, for God's sake. You treat him like a child. I won't discuss the inspector's health with you. He's still recovering, but he's not as vulnerable as you think. You've always underestimated people, Sylvain. That's your great weakness. You think others are weaker than they are, and that you're more powerful than you actually are. Which is it, Armand? Is Beauvoir still wounded, or is he stronger than I think? You might have fooled your people, mesmerized them with your bullshit, but not me." "No," said Gamache. "We know each other too well." François had begun to roam the room, pacing it. But Gamache stayed put in front of the door, his eyes never leaving the chief superintendent. "What did you say to Inspector Beauvoir?" Gamache repeated. "I told him what I told you, that you're incompetent and he deserves better." Gamache studied the prowling man, then shook his head. "It's more than that. Tell me." François stopped and turned to face Gamache. "My God, Beauvoir said something to you, hasn't he?" François got within inches of the chief, staring point-blank into his eyes, neither man blinking. "If he's not recovered from his wounds, they're wounds you made. If he's weak, it's a weakness you created. If he's insecure, it's because he knows he's not safe with you. And now you blame me?" François laughed, the peppermint breath hot and moist on Gamache's face. And again Gamache could feel his rage, so tightly contained, spill out. He fought with all his might to control it, knowing the enemy wasn't this leering, lying, vicious man, it was himself, and the rage that threatened to consume him.
"Jean-Guy Beauvoir is not to be harmed."
Each word was said slowly, clearly, precisely, and in a voice few had heard from the chief inspector, a voice that made his superior step back, that sizzled the smile right off the handsome face.
"It's too late, Armand," said Francois. "The harm's already done. And you're the one who did it, not me."
"Inspector?" Frère Antoine had been reading in his cell when he heard the footfall outside his door. He looked into the corridor and noticed the Sûreté officer standing there, looking confused.
"You look lost. Are you all right?"
"I'm fine," said Beauvoir, wishing people would stop asking him that. Once again the two men stared at each other. The same man, in so many ways. The same age, height, build. The same neighbourhood growing up. But one had entered the church and never left. The other had left the church and never returned. And now they looked at each other across the dim corridor of Saint-Gilbert-entre-les-Loups. Beauvoir approached the monk. "That fellow who just arrived, the Dominican, what's the story there?" Frère Antoine's eyes darted up and down the hallway. Then he stepped into his cell, and Beauvoir followed. It was exactly the same as the cell Beauvoir had been assigned, with a few personal tweaks. A sweatshirt and pants lay in a bundle in the corner. Books were stacked beside the bed. A biography of Maurice Richard. A hockey playbook, written by a former coach of the Montreal Canadiens. Beauvoir had those books, too. Hockey had replaced religion for most Quebecois. But here they seemed to coexist. On top of the pile was a history of a monastery in some place called Solesmes, and a Bible. "Frère Sébastien," said Brother Antoine, his voice not exactly a whisper, but low enough so that Beauvoir had to concentrate to hear, "is from the office in the Vatican that used to be known as the Inquisition." "I gathered that. But what's he doing here?"
"He said he came because of the prior's murder."
Frère Antoine didn't look any too happy about that. "But you don't believe it, do you?" Frère Antoine grinned just a little.
"Is it that obvious?"
"No, I'm just that observant." Antoine chuckled before growing serious again. "The Vatican might send a priest to investigate what happened in a monastery where there's been a murder. Not to find the killer, but to find out how the climate in an abbey got so bad there was a murder."
"But we know what went wrong," said Beauvoir. "You were all fighting over the chance, the recording."
"But why were we fighting?" asked Frère Antoine. He seemed genuinely perplexed. "I've been praying over it for weeks, months. We should have been able to resolve this. So what went wrong? And why didn't we see that one of us was not only capable of murder, but actually contemplating it?" Seeing the confusion, the pain in the monk's eyes, Beauvoir wanted to tell him, to answer his question. But he hadn't a clue what the answer was. He didn't know why the monks had turned on each other, just as he hadn't a clue why any of them were there in the first place, why any of these men were even monks. "You said the Vatican might send a priest, but you don't seem convinced. Do you think he's not who he says he is?"
"No. I believe he really is Frère Sébastien, and that he works for the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in Rome. I just don't think he's here because of the murder of Frère Mathieu."
"Why not?" Beauvoir sat on the wooden chair, and the monk sat on the side of his bed.
"Because he's a monk, not a priest. I think they'd send someone more senior for something this serious."
"But really," Frère Antoine tried to find the words to express what was mostly a feeling, an intuition, "the Vatican doesn't move this fast. Nothing in the church moves quickly. It's mired in tradition. There are proper procedures for everything."
"Even murder?"
Antoine grinned again. "If you studied the Borgias, you know the Vatican has a tradition of that, too. So yes, even murder. The CDF might send someone to investigate us, but not so quickly. It'd take them months, maybe even years, for them to act. Frère Mathieu would be dust. It's inconceivable a Vatican man would arrive before the prior is even buried."
"Then what's your theory?"
The monk thought,
then shook his head. "I've been trying to figure it out all evening."
"So are we," Beauvoir admitted, then regretted giving out that information. The less a suspect knew of the investigation, the better. Sometimes they planted information to unnerve a suspect, but it was always deliberate. This was an unguarded slip.
"I have those books," he said, hoping to cover up his indiscretion.
"The hockey ones? You play?"
"Center. You?"
"Center, too. But I have to admit there wasn't much competition for the position once Frère Eustache died of old age."
Beauvoir laughed, then sighed.
"Do you want to talk about it?" Frère Antoine asked.
"About what?"
"Whatever it is that's eating you."
"All that's eating me is trying to find a killer and getting out of here."
"You don't like the monastery?"
"Of course not."
"You do?"
"I wouldn't be here if I didn't," said Frère Antoine. "I love Saint-Gilbert." It was such a simple statement it left Beauvoir dumbfounded. He'd said it in the same way Beauvoir might talk about Annie. No confusion, no ambiguity. It just was. Like the sky just was, and the stones just were. It was natural and absolute.
"Why?"
Beauvoir leaned forward. It was one of the questions he'd been dying to ask this monk with the beautiful voice and the body so like his own.
"Why do I love it here?"
"What's not to love?" Frère Antoine looked around his cell as though it was a suite at the Ritz in Montréal. "We play hockey in the winter, fish in the summer, swim in the lake and collect berries. I know what each day will bring, and yet each day feels like an adventure. I get to hang around men who believe as I do, and yet are different enough to be endlessly fascinating. I live in the house of my father and learn from my brothers. And I get to sing the words of God in the voice of God." The monk leaned forward, his strong hands resting on his knees.
"Do you know what I found here?"
Beauvoir shook his head.
"I found peace."
Beauvoir felt his eyes burn and sat back, deeply ashamed of himself.
"Why do you investigate murders?" Frère Antoine asked.
"Because I'm good at it."
"And what makes you good at it?"
"I don't know."
"Yes, you do. You can tell me."
"I don't know," snapped Beauvoir. "But it's better than sitting on my ass or on my knees praying to some cloud in the sky. At least I'm doing something useful."
"Have you ever killed anyone?" the monk asked, his voice quiet.
Beauvoir, taken aback, nodded.
"I haven't," said Frère Antoine.
"Have you ever saved anyone?" Beauvoir asked. Now Frère Antoine looked surprised. After a moment's silence, he shook his head.
"I have," said Beauvoir, getting to his feet. "You just keep singing, mon frère, keep praying, keep kneeling, and let others stand up and do the saving."
Beauvoir left, and was halfway back to the prior's office before he heard Frère Antoine's voice.
"There is one person I've saved."
Beauvoir stopped and turned around. The monk was standing in the dim corridor outside his cell.
"Myself."
Jean-Guy snorted, shook his head, and turned his back on Frère Antoine. He hadn't believed a word of it. Certainly hadn't believed the monk when he talked about his love of the monastery. It was impossible to love the pile of stones and the old bones that rattled around inside it, hiding from the world, hiding from their reason. It was impossible to love singing the deathly dull music, or a god who required it of them. And he wasn't at all sure he believed Frère Antoine when the monk said he'd never killed. Once inside the prior's office, Jean-Guy Beauvoir leaned against the wall, then bent over, placing his hands on his knees. He took a deep breath in, a deep breath out. Chief Inspector Gamache returned to the prior's office, carrying a new chair.
Salut, he said to Beauvoir, then placed the broken chair in the corridor, hoping a carpenter monk might find it and fix it. Gamache had things of his own to fix. He indicated the chair, and Beauvoir sat.
What did Superintendent Francois say to you?
Beauvoir looked at him, astonished.
I told you. Just shit about how incompetent you are, like I don't already know. But his attempt at levity sat on the desk between them. Gamache didn't crack a smile, didn't take his eyes off his second in command. There was more, though, the chief said, after considering Beauvoir for a few quiet moments. Francois said more, or insinuated. "You need to trust me, Jean-Guy."
There was nothing more.
Beauvoir was looking tired, drawn, and Gamache knew he needed to send Beauvoir back to Montréal. He'd find some pretext. Jean-Guy could take back the murder weapon and the vellum they found on the body. Now that copies had been made, the original could go to the lab. Yes, there were plenty of good reasons to send Jean-Guy back to Montréal, including the real one. "I think when people care about each other, they want to protect them," said Gamache, choosing his words carefully. "But sometimes, like blocking a goalie in hockey or soccer, instead of protecting them, you're just making it harder for them to see what's coming. Harm is done. By mistake." Gamache leaned a fraction further forward, and Beauvoir leaned away, just a fraction. "I know you're trying to protect me, Jean-Guy, and I appreciate it. But you have to tell me the truth."
"And you, sir? Are you telling me the truth?"
"About what?"
"About the leaked video of the raid. About how it got out. The official report was a cover-up. That video was leaked internally, but you seem to believe the official report."
"A hack on my ass." "Is that it? Did Superintendent Francois say something about the video to you?"
"No. It's my own question.
And I've answered it before." He looked closely at Beauvoir. "Where did this suddenly come from? What do you want me to say?"
"That you don't believe the report. That you're privately investigating. That you'll find out who did it. They were our people. Your people. You can't just leave it like this."
His voice was spiraling out of control. Beauvoir was right, of course. The video had been leaked internally. Gamache had known that from the moment it had happened. But he'd chosen to, officially anyway, accept the finding of the internal investigation, that some kid, some hacker, had just gotten lucky and found the video of the raid in the Sûreté files. It was a ludicrous report. But Gamache had told his people, including Beauvoir, to accept it, to let it go, to move on. And as far as he knew, they all had, except Beauvoir. And now, Gamache wondered if he should tell him that for the past 8 months, he and a few other senior officers, with the help of some outsiders, were secretly, carefully, quietly investigating. "Some malady is coming upon us." But in the case of the Sûreté du Québec, it had already arrived, had been there for years, rotting away from the inside, and from the top down. Sylvain Francois had been sent to the monastery to gather information, not about the murder of the prior, but to find out how much Gamache might know, or suspect. And Francois had tried to get at it through Beauvoir, pushing and prodding and trying to thrust him over the edge. Once again, Gamache felt that lick of rage. He wished he could tell Beauvoir everything, but he was deeply glad he hadn't. Francois would leave Jean-Guy alone now, satisfied that while Gamache might still be up to something, Beauvoir wasn't. Francois would be satisfied that he'd gotten all he could from Beauvoir. Yes, Francois had been sent with an agenda, and Gamache had finally figured out what it was. But Gamache had a question of his own. Who had sent the chief superintendent? Who was the top boss's boss?
"Well?" Beauvoir demanded.
"We've been through this before, Jean-Guy," said Gamache. "But I'm happy to talk about it again, if it'll help." He looked directly at Beauvoir over his half-moon reading glasses. It was a gaze Jean-Guy had seen often, in trappers' cabins, in shitty little motel rooms, in restaurants and bistros, burger and poutine in front of them, and notebooks open, talking about a case, dissecting the suspects, the evidence, tossing around ideas, thoughts, wild guesses. For more than 10 years Beauvoir had looked into those eyes, over those glasses. And while he hadn't always agreed with the chief, he'd always respected him, loved him even, in the way only one brother-in-arms could love another. Armand Gamache was his chief, his boss, his leader, his mentor, and more. One day, God willing, Gamache would hold his grandchildren in that gaze. Jean-Guy's children, Annie's children. Beauvoir could see the pain in those familiar eyes, and he couldn't believe he'd put it there. "Forget I said anything," Beauvoir said. "It was a stupid question. It doesn't matter who leaked the video, does it?" Despite himself, he heard the plea in those last words. Gamache leaned back heavily and watched Beauvoir for a moment. "If you want to talk about it, I will, you know." But Beauvoir could see what saying this cost Gamache. Beauvoir knew he wasn't the only one who'd suffered that day in the factory, that day captured by the video and released into the world. Beauvoir knew he wasn't the only one who still bore the burden of survival. "The damage is done, Patron. You're right. We need to move on." Gamache removed his glasses and looked directly at Beauvoir. "I need you to believe something, Jean-Guy. Whoever leaked that video will answer for it one day." "Not just to us?" "We have our own work to do here, and frankly, I'm finding it hard enough." The chief smiled, but it didn't quite cover the watchfulness in his brown eyes. The sooner Gamache could get Beauvoir back to Montreal, the better. It was dark now, but he talked to the abbot and sent Beauvoir back first thing in the morning. Gamache pulled the laptop toward him. "I wish we could get this thing working." "No," said Beauvoir sharply. He leaned over the desk, his hand gripping the screen. The chief looked at him in surprise. Beauvoir smiled. Sorry, it's just that I was working on it this afternoon, and I think I've found the problem." "And you don't want me to screw it up, is that it?"
"Absolutely."
Beauvoir hoped his voice was light. He hoped his explanation was credible. But mostly, he hoped Gamache would back away from the computer. He did, and Beauvoir turned it around so that it faced him. The crisis was averted. He sat back down in his chair. The chronic ache had turned into a sharp pain that tunneled into Beauvoir's bones and ran through his marrow, like corridors, carrying the pain to every part of his body. Beauvoir began wondering how soon he could be alone in the office, with the computer and the DVD the superintendent had brought, and the pills the doctor had left. He now longed for the next service, so that while everyone else was in the blessed chapel, he could be in here. They spent the next 20 minutes discussing the case, throwing around theories, throwing out theories, until finally Gamache got to his feet. "I need a walk. Do you want to come?" Beauvoir's heart sank, but he nodded and followed Gamache into the corridor. They turned toward the blessed chapel when the chief suddenly stopped and stared at the electric light bulb attached to the wall. "Do you know, Jean-Guy, when we first arrived, I was surprised they had electricity here. Comes from solar and some hydropower they've hooked up to a nearby river, Frère Raymond told me. Want to know how it works?" He told me that as well. "Perhaps for my birthday, as a special gift," said the chief. "But what I'm wondering now is how that light got there." He pointed to the wall sconce.
"I don't understand, Patron. How does any light get on a wall? It's wired there."
"Exactly. But where are the wires? And where's the ductwork for the new heating system? And the pipes for the plumbing?"
"Where they are in any building," said Beauvoir, wondering if the chief had lost his mind. "Behind the wall."
"But the plan shows only one wall. The Gilbertine who built it took years, decades, to dig the foundation and put the walls up. It's an engineering marvel. But you can't tell me they designed it to have a geothermal unit and plumbing and that." Again he pointed to the light.
"You've lost me," admitted Beauvoir.
Gamache turned to him. "In your home, in mine, there are two walls, the exterior cladding and the interior drywall. And between the two is the insulation and the wiring, the plumbing, the vents." And then it clicked for Beauvoir. "They can't have passed the wires and pipes through solid stone. So this isn't the outside wall." He pointed to the field stones that made the wall. "There's another wall behind it."
"I think there must be. The wall you examined for flaws might not be the one that's crumbling. It's the outer wall that's breached by roots and water. It isn't yet noticeable inside."
Two skins, thought Beauvoir, as they resumed their walk and stepped into the blessed chapel. The public face, and then the crumbling, rotting one behind. He'd made a mistake.
hadn't looked hard enough. And Gamache knew it.
"Excusez-moi,"
a voice sang out, and the two men slowed and turned. They were crossing the Blessed Chapel.
"Over here."
Gamache and Beauvoir looked to their right, and there, in the shadows, stood the Dominican, beside the plaque to Gilbert of Sempringham. The two Sûreté men walked over.
"You look like you have some place to go," said Frère Sébastien. "If I'm disturbing you, we can talk later."
"We always have some place to go, mon frère," Gamache said. "And if we don't, we're trained to look as though we do."
The Dominican laughed. "The same with monks. If you go to the Vatican, we're always hurrying down corridors looking important. Most of the time, we're just trying to find a bathroom. The sad convergence of great Italian coffee and a shocking distance between toilets in the Vatican. The architects of St. Peter's were brilliant, but toilets weren't a priority. Superintendent Francois has told me something about the death of the prior. I wonder if we can talk some more about it. I get the feeling that while Monsieur Francois is in charge, you do most of the actual investigating."
"That's a fair assessment," agreed Gamache.
"What questions do you have?"
But instead of answering, the monk turned to the plaque.
"A long life Gilbert had, and an interesting description."
He gestured to the writing. "I find it strange that the Gilbertines themselves, who presumably made the plaque, should make him out to be so dull. But way down here, as an afterthought, they say he defended his archbishop."
Frère Sébastien turned to Gamache. "You know who that was?"
"The archbishop?" "Thomas of Becket."
Frère Sébastien nodded. In the uncertain light of the bulbs high in the rafters, shadows were distorted. Eyes became bleak holes. Noses were elongated, misshapen. The Dominican gave them a grotesque smile.
"A remarkable thing for Gilbert to do. I'd love to know why he did it."
"And I'd love to know, mon frère," said Gamache, not smiling, "why you're really here."
The question amazed the monk, who stared at Gamache, then laughed.
"I think we have a lot to talk about, monsieur. Shall we go into the chapter house? We won't be disturbed there."
The door to the room was through the plaque. Gamache knew it, Beauvoir knew it, and the monk seemed to know it. But instead of finding the hidden catch and opening it, Frère Sébastien waited for one of the others to do it. Chief Inspector Gamache considered the monk. He seemed pleasant. There was that word again, inoffensive. Happy in his work, happy in his life. Happy, certainly, to have followed the Angelus bells and found this secluded monastery. Built almost 400 years earlier by Dom Clément to escape the Inquisition. They'd faded into the Canadian wilderness and let the world believe the last rites were said for the last Gilbertine centuries ago. Even the church believed they'd gone extinct. But they hadn't. For centuries, these monks sat by the shores of this pristine lake, adoring God, praying to him, singing to him, and living lives of quiet contemplation. But never forgetting what drove them there. Fear. Fretting. As though the walls weren't high enough and thick enough, Dom Clément had taken one more measure. He built a room to hide in. The chapter house. In case. And tonight, the in case had finally happened. The Inquisition, in the person of this pleasant monk, had found the Gilbertine.
At last, Frère Sébastien had said when he first crossed the threshold, "I found you."
At last, thought Gamache. And now the Dominican from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith was asking a police officer to show him the secret door, to open it, to take away the Gilbertine's last hiding place. Gamache knew it no longer mattered. The secret was out. There was no more hiding to be done, and no need. The Inquisition had ended. But even so, Chief Inspector Gamache was loath to be the man who, after 400 years, opened that door for the hound of the Lord. All this went through Gamache's mind in a flash, but before he could say anything, Beauvoir stepped forward and pressed the image of the intertwined wolves. And the plaque clicked open.
"Merci," said the Dominican. "I wondered briefly if you knew how."
Beauvoir gave him a dismissive look. That would teach this young monk to underestimate him. Gamache stepped aside and gestured, inviting the monk to go first.
They stepped into the chapter house and sat on the stone bench that ran around the walls. Gamache waited. He wasn't going to start the conversation. So the three of them sat in silence. After a minute or so, Beauvoir began to fidget slightly. But the chief sat absolutely still, composed. Then a soft sound came from the monk. It took just a moment for the chief to recognize it. He was humming the tune Gamache himself had hummed over dinner. But it sounded different. Perhaps, Gamache thought, it was the acoustics of the room. But he knew, deep down, it wasn't that. He turned to the man next to him. Fra Sebastian had his eyes closed, his fine light lashes resting on his pale cheek, and a smile on his face. It felt as though the stones themselves were singing. It felt as though the monk had coaxed the music out of the air, out of the walls, out of the fabric of his robes. Gamache had the oddest sensation that the music was coming out of himself, as though the music was part of him, and he a part of it. It felt as though all of everything was broken down and swirled together, and out of that came this sound.
And the experience was so intimate, so invasive, it was almost frightening. And would have been, had the music itself not been so beautiful and calming. Then the Dominican stopped humming, opened his eyes, and turned to Gamache. "I'd like to know, Chief Inspector, where you heard that tune." Chapter 29. "I need to speak to you, Père Abbot," said Frère Antoine. From inside his office, Dom Philippe heard the request, or demand. Normally, he'd have heard the old iron knocker against wood, but these were far from normal times. The rod had been declared the weapon that had killed Frère Mathieu and taken away, and word had spread that the prior had been alive when Simon had found him, had received last rites while alive. It gave Dom Philippe immense peace of mind to know that, though he wondered why Simon hadn't mentioned it before. And then he found out. Mathieu had not only been alive, but he'd spoken, said one word to Simon. Homo. Dom Philippe was as baffled as anyone by that. With one word left to say in this world, why would Mathieu say homo? He knew what the congregation suspected, that Mathieu was referring to his sexuality, asking for some sort of forgiveness, some extreme unction. But the abbot didn't believe that was true. Not that Mathieu wasn't a homosexual, he might well have been, but Dom Philippe had been his confessor for many years, and Mathieu had never mentioned it. It might, of course, have been latent, deeply buried, and only came roaring to the surface with the blow to his head. Homo. Mathieu had cleared his throat, struggled to get the word out, Simon had said, and finally rasped, "Homo."
The abbot tried it, clearing his throat, saying the word. He repeated it, over and over, until he thought he had it, what Mathieu had done, what Mathieu had said, what Mathieu had meant. But then Frère Antoine had entered and bowed slightly to the abbot.
"Yes, my son, what is it?"
Dom Philippe rose to his feet.
"It's about Frère Sébastien, the visitor. He says he was sent from Rome when they heard about the death of the prior."
"Yes." The abbot indicated a seat next to him, and Frère Antoine took it. The choirmaster looked worried and had dropped his voice.
"I don't see how that can be."
"Why do you say that?" Though the abbot himself had already worked it out.
"Well, when did you inform the Vatican?"
"I didn't. I called Monsieur Doucette at the Archdiocese in Montréal. He informed the Archbishop of Quebec, and presumably the Archbishop told Rome."
"But when did you call?"
"Right after we called the police." Frère Antoine thought about that for a moment. "That would make it about 9:30 yesterday morning." It was, thought the abbot, the first civil exchange he'd had with Frère Antoine in months, and the abbot realized how much he missed this monk in his life, his creativity of thought, his passion, the debates over scripture and literature, not to mention hockey. But now it seemed restored, their common ground, the death of Mathieu, and the arrival of the Dominican.
"I've been thinking the same thing," Dom Philippe admitted, and looked into the small fire in his small rooms.
With the geothermal they had central heating, but the abbot was a man of traditions, and preferred an open window and the warmth of the hearth.
It was 6 hours later in Rome, said the abbot. Even if they reacted immediately, it seems unlikely Frère Sébastien could make it here this quickly.
Exactly, mon père, said Antoine.
It had been a long time since he'd called Dom Philippe that, having used the more stilted, more formal, colder Père Abbé for the past few months. And we both know the diocese moves like continental drift, and Rome as fast as evolution. The abbot smiled, then grew serious again.
So why is he here? Frère Antoine asked. If not because of Frère Mathieu's death?
Dom Philippe held Antoine's anxious eyes.
I don't know.
But for the first time in a long time, the abbot felt his heart calm, felt the crack that had caused him so much pain closing.
I'd like your thoughts on something, Antoine.
Certainly.
Frère Simon says that Mathieu said one word before he died. I'm sure you've heard that by now.
I have.
He said, homo.
The abbot watched for the choirmaster's reaction, but there was none. The monks were trained and accustomed to keeping their feelings and their thoughts to themselves.
Do you know what he might have meant?
Antoine didn't speak for a few moments and broke eye contact. In a place with few words, the eyes became key. To break contact was significant, but his eyes found their way back to the abbot. The brothers are wondering if he was talking about his sexuality. There was clearly more Frère Antoine wanted to say, and so the abbot folded his hands in his lap and waited. And they're wondering if he was referring specifically to his relationship with you. The abbot's eyes widened just a little to have heard it expressed so boldly. After a moment, he nodded.
I can see how they might think that. Mathieu and I were very close for many years. I loved him very much. I always will. And you, Antoine, what do you think?
I loved him too, like a brother. I've personally never seen any reason to believe he felt any differently about you or anyone.
I think I know what Mathieu might have said. Simon mentioned that he cleared his throat before speaking, then said, homo. I tried it a few times.
Frère Antoine looked both surprised and impressed.
And this is, finally, what I came to, what Mathieu might have been trying to say.
The abbot cleared his throat, or appeared to, then said, homo. Antoine stared, shocked. Then he nodded.
Bon Dieu, I think you're right.
He tried it himself, clearing his throat and saying, homo.
But why would Frère Mathieu say that? He asked the abbot. I don't know.
Dom Philippe held out his right hand, palm up, and Frère Antoine, after the slightest of hesitations, took it. The abbot laid his left hand on top of that and held the young hand as though it might be a bird.
But I do know it will be all right, Antoine. All manner of things shall be well.